Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and we're back with another great episode here for you, talking about a great, actually new kind of topic for us to discuss, kind of an offshoot of some other things we've covered in the past, and we'll get into that here shortly. But first, I of course want to start talking about who we have on the call with us, and that starts with the amazing, the incredible Sam Bradley, my co-host. How you doing, Sam?
I'm amazing and incredible. Thank you, Jamie. And we're going to have some fun tonight. We got some awesome guests on, and of course, Dr. Joe, and a return guest, Seth Hawkins. And we're going to talk about something different. Take me back to my ski patrol days, and he brought a friend with him. So we're going to have a great time. But first of all, hi, Dr. Joe.
Hi, guys. Good to be back again, as always.
So I'm going to tell a little story, and then I want Seth and Pierce to jump in on this. I don't know, a couple of weeks ago now, somebody posted on Facebook a story that the reason he pasted it, because this was involved a firefighter that used to work for our local department here, and they were up hiking around Mount Shasta in Northern California and watched this guy take a 1,000-foot fall, pretty significant fall, needless to say. So they automatically go into medic mode. The three of them worked for the same fire department, went into medic mode, but there really wasn't a whole lot they could do other than try and keep the guy warm, manage his airway such as they could and that kind of thing. And they realized the airway was a problem. Well, as fate would have it, there were five folks also hiking in a group, two of which were ER doctors locally. So they jumped in and did some pretty amazing stuff. They actually were able to create a trach. I don't know what they did to make a hole, but they were able to create an emergency airway with the tubing from a camelback. And they even used the bag for some other things. So unfortunately, the man didn't survive. But I got to tell you, Joe, you and I have talked about this a number of times about being creative in the backcountry when you have to and using what you have with you. And that was just a perfect example of that. So this kind of takes us into what Seth does, because they are mountain guys and they're doing some pretty fun stuff. And I want to talk about what they're doing. So we'll say hi to Seth and then he can introduce us to Pierce. Hi, Seth.
Hey there, everybody.
So tell people what you're doing. You're having a great time hiking around Maine right now, hey?
Yeah, so every 4 years, my group gives us a sabbatical. I'm off for a month. Off for me basically just means I have more chance to do the field medicine stuff that I love to do and don't have clinical shifts to clog me up in the way of it. So I'm actually out. I've driven up from North Carolina, where I live and work, to Maine. And so I was just climbing this morning in Maine at Acadia National Park and talking to some of the rangers here about their awesome support services and rescue systems. And this is an area of the country that's well known to my friend Pierce Beisinger, who's joining us today. So I can let him tell a little bit about his New England background. But I grew up here in New England, so it's a nice way to come home and show my kids where people cook seafood correctly and pronounce words in the correct grammar.
Okay.
That's debatable.
We're from all over the country, so you might have an argument there. So, hi, Pierce. Tell the folks about yourself.
Well, howdy there, and how are yous up in New England? It's good to talk with everybody. I did spend a fair amount of time in New England, and I would say that's where my mountain career and life started, knocking out the 4,000 footers of New Hampshire and getting involved with search and rescue while I was up in New Hampshire. So I'm envious of Seth's time away from clinical duties to spend more time up there.
So, Pierce, what do you do in real life when you're not jumping in, up and down mountains?
Well, ironically, I do a lot of that, but my day job, what pays the bills, is I work in cardiac surgery in Portland, Oregon now. So we relocated here from the East Coast about 3 years ago.
And you're a physician assistant, correct?
I am a physician assistant. Yeah, I've been doing cardiac surgery for about 7 or 8 years and orthopedics prior to that, and spend my spare time with Seth working on our little project company and also volunteering for Portland Mountain Rescue up and around Mount Hood.
Cool. So tell us about your little project with Seth. We want to hear about that.
Seth, you want to chat a little bit about vertical medicine resources?
Yeah, sure. I'll dive in and you can flesh it out. Essentially, it was recognizing that the mountaineering and rock climbing community had special medical needs and really deserved to get the same level of attention as far as applying medical science and evidence-based medicine to operations. So Pierce and I, as a physician assistant and a physician, joined up with two really phenomenal climber nurses named Brian and Deb Simon, both married, both traveling nurses with OR experience as far as their traditional jobs, but really outstanding climbers recreationally. And the four of us formed a company that just tried to bring practitioner level healthcare information to rock climbing and mountaineering communities and anybody really operating in a vertical environment, which would include trekking and high angle ropes courses and all sorts of things involving being off the deck. So we offer training courses, and we've developed some innovative products like chalk bags that climbers use with a first aid kit embedded in it. So yeah, we've really been trying to tackle the question of what's the cutting edge medical science for climbers and mountaineers with educational and product kind of resources. So when I heard about this story, since Pierce not only is intimately involved with our work in that company, but also is a responder with Portland Mountain Rescue, and actually I think he's chair, is that right, Pierce, of the education committee there, and really one of the most active responders that I know of at a advanced healthcare provider level into the field. I thought he'd be a great guy to speak to some of the issues that this involves.
Well, what did you think about that, Pierce? Were you aware of it at all? I don't know if I sent you the link to that story or not.
You know, I heard about the story as it was evolving, and I guess a little bit after the fact, Seth and I had just finished teaching a wilderness medicine course up on Mount Hood, and he's saying, "Hey, did you hear what happened on Shasta? And you know, what do you think about this?" And something about a tracheostomy and a camelback air bladder. Or a water bladder, I should say, that got converted to an air bladder. And I thought, wow, that's great, you know, application of improvised medicine in an austere environment. You know, it was really putting climbing medicine, in the spotlight. And it's unfortunate that the end result didn't bring out a recovery, but it certainly had all the resources and applications to make the best effort known. So that's it was neat to hear about. And
well, I think what I think is neat, I love teamwork. And, you know, pre-hospital care and docs don't always get along all that well sometimes, especially in trauma centers, it seems. But this was a scenario when that was called for. And when the three firefighters started doing what they do, but were very limited in what they could do. And I don't know all the components of this group, but two of them were ER docs from San Mateo. Now, any other doc may not have jumped in there unless it's their knowledge of mountaineering that would have pushed them in that direction. But ER docs certainly are kind of used to working on the fly and having to get creative. And that was just such a best case scenario. Everybody jumped in there and did what they were capable of doing to try and save this guy. And if he had had any chance at all, he certainly would have. And I just thought it was neat that ad hoc team came together and did what they were able to do. And get very creative in the process.
It certainly was a picture of the right place, right time, you mm-hmm. know, right people to be in place, for this event.
So, Seth, before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about the difference between outdoor emergency care, which is a National Ski Patrol curriculum, and emergency medical responder and EMT. And I think what you're saying is, mountaineering has its own unique needs in terms of medicine. So can you give us kind of a quick overview of what that means? What is it that's different about mountaineering medicine?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I think that's really ended up forming a big core of what I've tried to do in field medicine in general. So I think it's sort of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I think there's definitely unique features to mountain medicine and to remote medicine in general. Certainly there's specific
parameters around high angle rescue and climbing medicine. As we were talking about outdoor emergency care, which is the proprietary curriculum for the National Ski Patrol, as we're talking about mountain rescue teams like Pierce works with Portland Mountain Rescue, really the other side to that double-edged sword is that it's become a conviction of mine that these teams and field medical response units should be operating within the healthcare infrastructure rather than outside of it. So really, to me, it's important that field responders not be exempted from the same standards we would hold to other healthcare providers and the same regulatory infrastructure, which is sometimes alarming because we're from the government, we're here to help you, is not always the message that's most welcome.
We can say that, right, Jeff?
Yeah. being at times like with a DMAT team from the government and other times being the recipient of government services, I like many people on this call, I sit on both sides of that equation. But I do think that, and this is, I think, something that's formed a thread through both Pierce and my career, is that if field medicine is ever going to rise to the level where it's respected in the academic and hospital-based medical community and has credibility as a legitimate practice of medicine, it really needs to meet the same standards as you'd see in traditional front country medicine. So in the sense of OEC and National Ski Patrols and mountain rescue teams and all these kind of organizations, I think to me it's important that they have the same features that we see as requisite components of an EMS system. So they have adequate medical oversight, they've got quality management, they've got case review, they have people who are trained in clinical decision making and in modern evidence-based medicine that are reviewing cases. And I think, in this kind of case, this is what most people think of when they think of wilderness medicine, is this very dramatic, ad hoc, MacGyver-like improvisational care that throws together people from disparate backgrounds to solve a problem. And it makes an awesome, episode of a disaster podcast or of a TV show. That's really important. The other important thing to remember is that there was a team that came in to transport this patient once they were stabilized by this ad hoc physician firefighter team. And that's, I think, what that's a big thing we think about when we talk about OEC and wilderness response teams, is they should be trained and standardized to do that. In this particular case, you are so right that having providers work together in the field this way who don't have the same backgrounds and don't have the same experiences, I think Pierce could speak to this too, that often is not as functional as this sounded like it was. And there's as much arguing about who's carrying what card and what standards they're going to be following and what should be done for the patient than it sounds like in this case, some real innovative problem solving that may or may not have changed the outcome, but certainly did seem to be working in the best interest of the patient as far as trying to be as aggressive as possible in saving his life.
Well, I was just going to say, it seems that in this particular scenario, the priorities that you would see in front country, scenarios of airway management, that the priorities were there and the methodology of getting there was, like other aspects of wilderness medicine, improvised to the best of the resources available and the personnel available. I think what Seth is speaking to is that across the disciplines of field medicine and tactical medicine and search and rescue and climbing medicine, there's not exactly a standardization of curriculum in those various disciplines. And that also exists at the state level as well, as far as who's being regulated and how they're regulated. You often see physicians, not filling in their role what their daily role is, but because of who they work for, who they're volunteering with, serving in a different capacity, just to fit in the umbrella of the infrastructure. So I think that's a major discussion point where, these guys were doing the best they could, with the given resources at hand, and sort of lack of infrastructure, because it was an ad hoc group, not a formal rescue team.
Well, and I think another thing that made this work is there's such a difference in what paramedics could do in that scenario, and especially with no equipment, and what docs can do. Docs have a lot more leverage to be creative. A medic would be worried about losing his license if he tried to do something like that, because even if, you know, some kind of emergency crike is in your scope of practice, if you're not working for an ALS agency at the time, we could lose our licenses over that. So there is a clean enough split to what we could do versus what you could do that there really wasn't any dissension about, well, we do it this way, no, we do it this way, which I think, Seth, is that's what you're talking about. But am I hearing, too, that kind of the big push that you guys are doing is, for a reason that you mentioned QI and those things, is safety. I mean, if you don't have an organized way of doing things, if you don't have the same understanding of what it is you're doing, then there could be a bad outcome for the patient, or they could be a bad outcome for a team member. Is that kind of where you're going with this?
Don't everybody talk at once.
I know. I must have stunned them with that one. I don't know.
I'll change directions just a little bit, because, you know, one of the things I'm taken by on that story is, and we sort of talked about this in the past with Dr. Diamond, and I know we've sort of touched on it before in other episodes, about sort of where the ego comes into play. And, you know, for so many people, it's an ego-driven deal, and it's much more about their ego than it is doing the right thing for the patient and trying to, you know, not let that get in the way. I think that also is a huge plus for being able to standardize things as well. When you know, especially organizations like this that tend to be to have a lot of volunteer folks involved. You know, that's great in that the manpower doesn't cost you much, but at the same time, it's often really challenging to get consistency out of that, because, you know, I'm volunteering and I'm going to do it my way. And if you don't like it, then, you know, I'm just leaving. You know, I think that applies to disaster medicine, just like it does almost anything else, where you've got folks that are, you know, out there doing disaster medicine. Those are the folks that tend to, you know, self-deploy and wreak all the havoc that we've talked about there and that sort of stuff. So it's not an area where a big ego really serves you very well, I think.
No, in fact, it could very much get in the way. And I think that was my question, Seth, kind of restated, is do you think that there is some safety for everyone in having some standardized protocols?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is Seth, and I think that's partly what we're all trying to work towards, is to have, on the one hand, to have standardized definitions of even what certification levels are. So the interesting thing to many people, you know, might be that and this is also somewhat true of disaster medicine, that in wilderness medicine, there's really no standardization of what various levels mean. So to say that you're a wilderness EMT or a wilderness paramedic or a wilderness PA, it really only means as much as the curriculum that's set behind it from the training organization, which, of course, in the eyes of the state, in the eyes of a credentialing body, is pretty meaningless. So it's wilderness medicine is a fascinating area where our educational elements have far outstripped our operational elements. And that is a safety issue, in the sense that if you're doing something as a paramedic that you've been trained to do, like a dislocation reduction or an airway intervention, like establishing a and you do it wrong, or you do it incorrectly, or there's some bad outcome from it, and that can be traced back to you, and suddenly you're told, you know, in this jurisdiction or in this environment or in this setting, it was not appropriate for you to be doing in the first place. There's a danger to you, you know, from a regulatory standpoint. In theory, there would be a danger to the patient to have people doing things unnecessarily. I think, you know, we're all moving from the supposition in this case that the patient required this airway intervention to have any chance to survive. And I acknowledge that that's a supposition. I wasn't there and I don't know that level of detail. And of course, if somebody tried at a
paramedic level to try to do, a surgical airway on somebody who was really not needing it, that could be quite problematic, yeah. And we might not be so laudatory. So, yeah, I think all those safety issues are kind of there. Actually, the National Association of EMS Physicians at this very moment is working on some standardization language and consensus documents simply to try to start to build around this topic some sense of the scope of practice and the minimum standards for various trainings, which is great. And then, just like you're saying, it throws us back into the environment where you have a bunch of people who probably are not wilderness EMS practitioners. They're probably front country practitioners who happen to be in that environment. They're going to fall back on the skills and scope of practice that they know. And then you really, just like you're saying, hope that they have the best interests of the patient in mind and they're trying to do the right thing. But that truly is the heart and soul of Good Samaritan care. And in that case, you just... at the time of care, and that's true of disaster medicine and wilderness medicine, you're trying to do the best thing for somebody that you can given the training that you have, which speaks back to the very, basics of the Hippocratic Oath and the fundamentals of why we learn medicine in the first place. So I think all that's really important. I think people need to remember what their scope of practice is and what the legitimate boundaries of their training are in a disaster setting when, your city is flooded and you're needing to save as many lives as possible. You're pretty much, doing the best you can.
Yeah, well, you reminded me of something in all of this, because we have a state disaster team here as well. And to be honest, in California, it's really a bunch of DMATters that put a different shirt on, but, because they're already trained in disaster medicine. But one of the problems we ran into is we have a contract with Cal Fire to work as medical support for their larger fire campaigns, like the 2007 San Diego fires and such. And one of the problems we ran into is we have paramedics from all over the state coming together, working in a particular county where we're not accredited. And, even though the different jurisdictions recognized we were there to help, there were others that are going, well, wait a minute, you can't do this. I mean, if it was an optional skill in my county, it maybe wouldn't be down there. So it kind of fell on the state medical director to figure out how to make all of that work. And I can kind of see in your scenario why, well, this is what we do. Well, no, this is what we do, but I can't do that. If you had your own standards specific to that environment you're in, then that would not be an issue. Or just, like you said, Joe mentioned, the difference in training that different people have, even though everybody is trying to do the right thing, it's not a good time to be sitting there arguing how best to do something when everybody has a different opinion. So I can see where that would be really beneficial to say, no, we're working under this standard because we're in this environment.
Well, Seth actually touched on this. We were talking about this just before we got going, and that sort of leads to this whole issue about how do states look at these different groups like that. Seth was chatting about the CIMSO, which is the National Association of State EMS Officials, and we struggle in that forum every year with sort of. How do you ensure that the people that are coming into your state to help out are the right folks and are properly credentialed and how long they're going to be there? And the people inside the state are complaining that these guys are coming in and taking our jobs and, all kinds of stuff. It gets fraught with an awful lot of political overtones before you know it.
And that's going to wrap up this particular episode here of the Disaster Podcast. We actually ended up going along again on this recording. It was such good stuff that we split it into two episodes. So come back next week for the second half of this episode. We'll be talking a little bit more about what Seth and Pierce and others in the vertical medicine and wilderness medicine arenas are doing to standardize the levels of care for this particular type of responder, and what they plan on doing is with regards to certifications and maybe credentialing of wilderness and vertical medicine emergency responders. So stay tuned for that. A special thank you again to Paragon Medical Education Group and their continued sponsorship of this show. You really need to head over and check out their website, follow the link over at disasterpodcast.com, or head directly to their links. with Dr. Joe Holly and Jim Logan and the rest of the team over there. They really put together amazing training and education resources for the emergency responders and disaster responders out there. So take advantage of the incredible resources they have to bring to bear by bringing them into your system and preparing your responders in a way that you really can't get anywhere else. And you can find them on the web at ParagonMedEDU in Twitter, as well as ParagonMedicalGroup.com over at their website. So check them out. And again, thanks to Joe and the rest of the gang over there for helping us out. That's it for me, for Sam Bradley and myself and the rest of the team here at DisasterPodcast.com. We're going to go ahead and close out this episode. And we will just remind you that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.